Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to The Zapcast, the only podcast where an evil woman will make you cry if you believe her every time she lies. And I'm here with...
That's right.
Conceptual continuity, baby. I'm here, of course, with our producer, Philip Circus.
Hello, Scott.
Who provided us with lovely new microphones. And, of course, People Magazine's Sexiest Vaultmeister Alive 2022, Joseph Travers, ladies and gentlemen. Woo!
Nice.
You know, Scott, people can't see what you're wearing, but you're wearing a Woodstock shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I just watched the movie literally like 2 days ago.
Did you?
Yeah, I had to watch it again. It was the it was the first time I watched it since you and I were there.
Did it take you back?
Totally. It was so neat.
Can you imagine being in the middle of that crowd?
Are you talking about the Woodstock movie or one of the other Woodstock movies?
No, the Woodstock movie. But I watched the Blu-ray director's cut, so extended.
Yeah.
That crowd was that was out of control. Like, of course it was a disaster area. Of course it was.
How could it not be?
My God.
It's that red clay mud. It gets everywhere, boy. And you know what's funny about Woodstock is that was the weekend that the original Mothers of Invention broke up.
August.
Wow.
Well, it was a couple days later, but it was
late
that
August.
Because wasn't I think Montreal or something was the last show. So that was.
Yeah.
So that week. So people say, you know, like, why didn't Frank play? Well, Frank was asked to, but they turned it down.
Yeah, it was weird timing for Frank. And he was working on Hot Rats and Burnt Weenie Sandwich at that time and at TTG.
I mean, you know, once you hear Hot Rats, you start to realize that there's no viable path forward for the original Mothers. Like, he'd kind of already done it, you know.
Yeah.
Sad to say, but you know, but still true. But of course, folks, we are here talking about, I don't even know where to begin with this one, but
Hot Rats 2.
I think probably my second favorite of the archival releases, next to, I mean, because you can't, you know, Hot Rat Sessions is just so thorough, you know, and nothing could ever be as thorough as that, but it is a very close second, which is Waka Wazoo, ladies and gentlemen, the new 4-CD set chronicling the making of the Waka Jawaka and Grand Wazoo albums, and with a special live performance thrown in. So we're going to get into all that, folks.
Yeah,
it's sexy. And since we're here with People Magazine's 2022 winner of the Sexiest Vaultmeister Alive contest, here we are talking.
You've got the inside scoop.
This is how it works now. You know, it's 50th anniversary, so this is pretty much how these things work.
Yeah, pretty much. I knew that there was potential to release this because I documented the tapes kind of, I don't know, maybe like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew what the content of those original multi-tracks were. But, once it came time to like bring the hammer down and start really compiling something that for release, it was like, oh, okay, cool. So yeah, really it came together. It came together pretty easily actually, but man, there's some great shit in this.
Yeah. I mean, from the moment that I put on, cause the first track on it is Take One of Your Mouth, which is, you know, if somebody put a gun to my head, I might put Your Mouth in my top five favorite Frank songs of all time, just because it's so freaking sleazy. You know, I just love that sleaziness. And this take is even sleazier. And what is amazing to me is that that's live in the studio.
Yep, exactly.
So they did a lot of that track live.
Yeah, I think the vocals and the horn parts and all that stuff got overdubbed later. But as you can hear, that the track was pretty together in the studio already, as opposed to some of the other songs, which wasn't completely together when they were recording it. Like, it was just like frameworks, but Your Mouth was pretty much there.
Yeah. And who's it? Chris Peterson and Sal Marquez on the vocals. Yeah. What do we know about Chris Peterson?
Well, there's an interview with her that Andrew Greenaway did. That's pretty interesting you know, she talks about she was friends with Sal and she was from Detroit, I think. You have to correct me if I'm wrong on that. But Sal brought her in and she got a chance to work with Frank Zappa on a song. She was part of a band, and I don't really know how long her career really lasted. I tell you, she's got some cool chops. Like, she's got real bluesy, cool chops. You know, you could tell that she was hip and happening in 1972.
That interaction at the beginning of the track between her and Sal is just friggin' priceless.
Like, I know.
It's so funny because it's obvious that they know each other well,
yeah.
You know, and they're just riffing off each other. And it's just great.
Totally.
I'm glad you left all that in because that was, you know, that's a lot of fun.
I just thought of a question that isn't on my very short list of questions. So this is the first track on this box set.
On Reel One.
Is that the first thing recorded since The Rainbow?
That's correct. Yep.
Holy.
Wow.
I got to say it. Yep. Holy fucking shit.
Yep.
Scott, I'm really glad you brought it up because listening to this track, it's so bluesy. It's kind of a little bit of Hint of Road Ladies, but it's also like funky. And it's like you were saying, sleazy is a great word for it.
Yeah.
It's just something. It's just another world from the last thing that was recorded. Is so amazing.
No, it's true.
I mean, it's kind of unlike any other blues that he did in that way. Just that vibe, you know? And on the album, of course, followed by It Just Might Be a One-Shot Deal, which is also unlike anything else that Frank recorded, you know, with that Sneaky Pete pedal steel part. Friggin' beautiful. One of the most beautiful moments in Frank's studio work. Just right there.
And what's crazy is that there wasn't any additional takes of that song. Like,
that was it.
No additional solos of Sneaky Pete or anything. No, they really got through that song, you know, once. That was it.
That solo was a one take solo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
Yep.
I mean, he was ready to get back into the studio, boy, once he had recuperated enough. Because, of course, you know, for those of you out there listening who don't know the story, I'm sure you all do. Frank had been pushed off the stage at the Rainbow in London the previous December and had spent pretty much the next at least 6 months solidly in the wheelchair. I mean, he was hobbling for a while even after that, but, you know, it kept him out of the studio for a while until he could go to Paramount and do these things. You know, Paramount's a big room too, right?
I think so. Yeah, was in there. I was in there. It's really funky in there.
Yeah.
It's a nice studio. It's still happening. And Frank really worked a lot out of that studio for a few years anyway with Kerry McNabb, and some of his most, literally most popular records were recorded at that place, either recorded there or at least mixed there or worked on in there. If you think about the string of albums that came out of Paramount, that was like the golden era of 70s Zappa, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a cool place, and all the stuff at Waka for Waka Jawaka and the Grand Wazoo was tracked there.
And kind of interchangeably, too, which is what a lot of people, I don't think, realize. I'm not even sure that I knew to what extent that those albums were recorded at the same time.
Yeah, they sure were. And it's funny because, you know, Waka Jawaka is listed as a Frank Zappa record and the Grand Wazoo is listed as the Mothers, right? Yeah. But I really believe that that was just a way for Frank to be able to release two records so close together in the marketplace under Warner Brothers umbrella, because they had to justify how do we release two records so quickly, you know? Well, give them different artist titles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, Waka Jawaka is sort of hot rats too, as Phil was saying before. So, you know, I thought that was probably the reason for, you know, the artist's name, but I think you're probably much more correct.
Well, the real Hot Rats 2 is coming around the corner, babies.
Uh-oh.
So we won't talk about that quite yet.
There's so much to dive into in this set, you know, like, because this is a particularly fascinating period for me because, you know, post-assault and all that stuff. But one of the first things I had to rush to was Think It Over. And we finally, for the first time ever, have a version of Think It Over, aka the Grand Wazoo, with the lyrics.
Good call. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it was awesome.
It was really,
like, it's one of my favorite moments.
And not only was it an amazing discovery to actually hear that come up on the multi-tracks, but it's on an alternate take, which is interesting. So in other words, those lyrics weren't recorded on the master take. They were recorded and overdubbed on an alternate take.
Wow.
So that was interesting.
Is that Sal?
You know, I think it is. You know, sometimes when I was listening to these vocals soloed up, it sounded like Froggy to me at times. There's not much difference, really, I don't think, between Froggy's vocals and Sal's vocals sometimes to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do believe that it is Sal. Yes.
Because we know the lyrics. I mean, the lyrics have been out there for a while.
But never been heard.
No, you've never heard them sung. And it was pretty, well, maybe not exactly, but it was pretty close to what I thought it would be. And I was just so friggin' stoked by that. It's like, you know, and Michelle, my wife, for those of you who don't know, is sitting there like watching me listen to this. And I'm like, I'm pointing at the thing and jumping up and down, go, holy shit, it's there. And she's like, you've never heard this before? I said, there's an entire vault of stuff I've never heard. I said, I don't know everything, you know, so.
I actually talked to Sal Marquez on the phone about a week and a half ago for the first time in my life. We've never met. Yeah, we never met. Never met the guy. He's still alive. He's still kicking. He's still playing, too. But, yeah, I wanted to make sure that we were in touch with him because I wanted him to know that this was coming out and that we were going to provide him with a copy and wanted to make sure he was doing okay and that he was in my thoughts because, you know, this is the 50th anniversary of when their relationship started, Sal and Frank, you know. And he's all over this thing, Sal Marquez. He's just all over it. His trumpet playing is amazing. And he's singing on it, and he ended up being in the band, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I always looked at Sal as, he is to, I don't know, this is a really weird thing to say, but he is to trumpet as Bruce Fowler is to trombone, you know, more so than Walt Fowler is, because, you know, Sal's one of those guys that is just a complete and utter virtuoso on his instrument. And it's really regrettable that he didn't last longer in the band. Because he also had some lead vocal chops, too. You know, like if things had worked out in a certain way, you know, he theoretically could have been, you know, Napoleon, you know, if you think about it. I think he could have. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's going too far. But I have always really enjoyed his work on this album. And I actually think his playing was one of the things that makes this era so distinctive. Because Frank was kind of almost crafting, like when Frank would say that he would create arrangements or create parts or whatever specifically for certain players, this is a good example of that because, you know, Sal is just a monster, you know. And I mean, I think this year in 72, the caliber of the musicianship in the Mothers changed and it became more about virtuosity. Well, George Duke was really the first guy, but Sal is definitely in that mix. And, you know, this is a loving testament to his playing.
No doubt. As we know, Frank always had a knack of getting the best out of anyone that would work with him. And you can hear that on these sessions. You hear him pulling, making the final result, actually, of Waka Jawaka, for instance, all those overdubbed trumpets and stuff on that final version. And what's interesting is when you listen to the alternate take or the alternate version on the box set and you hear what the skeleton of that song sounded like in the studio and then how Frank constructed that absolutely gorgeous, brilliant, iconic ending with all those overdubbed trumpets and everything. And he was thinking about quadraphonic sound when he was recording that too. It, literally on the tape box, you can see a Kerry McNabb's diagram about where the trumpets are to be placed in the quadraphonic set. Huh. Right? I mean, they recorded it. They recorded it that way. So, I mean, just more and more examples of Frank always pushing the boundaries and, you know.
And we had a little bit of that on Quadiophilia, right?
All these new questions are popping in.
Go for it, Phil.
So one thing I was curious about, like how Kerry McNabb came into the fold, because this is so well recorded. It's amazing. But I'm also wondering, are the Dolby Atmos mixes at all paying homage to the original quadraphonic intentions?
Yes, I made sure of that.
Wow.
Well, I made sure that it was the quadraphonic intention about how those the specific things that I just mentioned about the placement of the horns.
Yeah.
I made sure about that. But what we didn't do is see that album, that whole album was not mixed in quad, just that one song was. Mm. And the one song that showed up on Quadiophiliac, that was not representative of the final version of the master that's on the album, because the end of the song is Frank soloing on that Moog frequency shifter instead of the brilliant ending that we just discussed. So it wasn't like we put that quadraphonic mix up and listened intently to where Frank placed everything and tried to replicate that. I think those guys, Karma Auger and Eric Goebel, they had so much more to work with in the end with all the different overdubs and the final versions of all that stuff. So they really did an amazing job of filling the space up with all those beautiful instruments. And they had such an amazing soundscape to work inside of. So they really kicked ass on that Dolby Atmos mix for both of those records. It's incredible. It's a benchmark. It's the bar has been raised. The technology is new. And again, Frank Zappa's music leads the pack. I'm sorry, but it's true. Frank was a surround pioneer.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud that people are listening to those Atmos mixes and with their eyes wide open, and they're just going, wow, listen to that. This music lends itself to that. It lends itself to that technology. And it's just beautiful to see people realize that in real time. It's wonderful. But yes, we replicated like the solo, Sal's trumpet solo travels in the sound. Yeah. We made sure that was exactly replicated. And, wow. And
that's
stuff
so cool.
Like
my original question is, do you happen to know how Carrie McNabb came into the picture?
So Carrie and I met during the classic albums, Apostrophe, Overnight Sensation filming. He came to the house and I brought him into the vault and we had a one-on-one in there together, which was really nice. And then he had a chance to come up and be interviewed and on the console for the show and all that stuff. It was really great. And unfortunately, I don't think I remember asking him, how did you get involved? But he told me that these sessions were the first things that he ever worked on. Mm. And right after that, he went on the road with Frank, in Europe in 1973. And that was one of the only times I think that he toured, because Barry Keane was still recording at that time too on the road. Well, there was a bunch of different people actually in 73. But yeah, so Carrie went on the road in Europe in late 73, but he was a Caribou when they did that stuff, which ended up being One Size Fits All. And he recorded the Armadillo show, the Bongo Fury show. He recorded Baby Snakes. Yeah. So Carrie was definitely there for a long time. But yeah, he was like, yeah, these are the first tapes that I ever worked on. Like I showed him the tapes,
It's so good. Coming off of all the prior albums, when you hear this, it's definitely moved into this kind of 70 close miking of the drums, stereo everything, stereo Rhodes. Even the bass sounded like I was getting some stereo ambience. It's amazing.
It's my favorite bass sound of all of Frank's records, the entire canon, the entire catalog. Erroneous's bass sound on these tracks, it's my favorite. It's better than Tom Fowler.
Do you know the recipe to like how that sound was achieved?
A pick.
Yeah.
And Carrie McNabb's beautiful fucking ears and Erroneous's tone.
Yeah.
Like the way he plays and stuff.
Yeah.
For me, that is the quintessential bass guitar tone.
No, it's
right
fantastic.
There.
And it's all up in this box set. It sounds so great.
Yeah.
It's so great.
So great.
Now, on the subject of Alex, I don't even know how do we even say, okay, Scott, how do we say his last name?
I believe it's Demachowski.
Very nice.
Yes.
So he definitely has an amazing sound like we just described, but he also, he struggled in the sessions. I mean, that's some challenging music for anybody, really, especially when you're learning all that stuff on the spot. And he really did a good job. But there were some parts where it was like, whoo, he was out to green blats, as Frank would say. So So we did a little bit of fixing on some of that stuff, like most specifically the Blessed Relief alternate take. Yeah, that was, whew. Alex was, he was hurting on some of that stuff. He would just get lost in the form, you know? And then when he would get lost, he'd play all these notes and we're just like, where are you going? And then he would try to get back on the wagon, you know, like try to get back on the train. Yeah. And, but you know, other than that, you know, it wasn't that many fixes, but you know, he really does sound amazing on these sessions. It's too bad he didn't, I mean, Tom Fowler is such a better, overall, just a better bass player and so great. So it makes sense that Tom would end up being the guy, even though Dave Parlato came after Alex. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely a difference between Dave Parlato and Tom Fowler. And I could see how Tom Fowler would get the gig because he's just got the execution. You know, he's just got the execution. The guy can play so well. And Dave was much more jazzier and kind of searching and wandering and but still really beautiful, you know, playing with a pick and very melodic. But yeah, so that's just how my thoughts about Frank's bass players during this time period. But yeah, Erroneous, great, amazing bass tone, sounds great on this thing.
It does.
I always thought Erroneous because, you know, you bring him into rehearsal and say, okay, now you have to work with Ainsley Dunbar.
Well, Ainsley brought him in.
That's what, yeah, that is true. They were, he came in through Ainsley. But you definitely know far more than we do in terms of like how well he fared during the sessions. But yeah, he did hold his own. And what Frank got out of him was fantastic, you know?
Yep. So it works. It definitely works.
And big time shout out to Ainsley also for not only coming back, but for playing so beautifully.
Can you believe that's the same drummer? The last box set.
Yes, yes. You know, this is the last days of Ainsley with Frank.
Yeah. Do you happen to know why he didn't stay? I mean, I know he was working with the Turtles, so the Fluorescent Leech and Eddie band.
You know, musically, it started to change. Ainsley said that in the beginning, Ainsley was allowed to just basically contribute to the music the way, just like he would just play the way that he plays, you know, and Frank would just give him a palette to play over and just go. But he said that Frank's music started changing and becoming more and more difficult, and he was looking for more intricate parts. Like he was looking for more intricate stuff instead of, oh, just play whatever you want over this. He was kind of refining it and looking for more, I guess, a more compositional approach to the drums. And Ainsley started feeling like he wasn't really the guy for that approach. And also, he did get other offers. He ended up, Ainsley's career, when you think about it, gosh, he went and played with the Turtles and stuff, but then he was in David Bowie and Lou Reed, and he was all up in that scene, which was in the height of its popularity at that point, you know?
Yeah.
Like Lou Reed was doing Transformer and Bowie was ruling the world and mm-hmm. coming off the Ziggy Stardust phenomenon. And so Ainsley was all up in it, and he was working with Bob Ezrin, you know, who was a very amazing producer. And so Ainsley and Bob was getting him gigs. And so Ainsley kind of went off into a different chapter of his career. But that's what I know.
Yeah, because you could see it. I mean, I guess, you know, if you're talking about something like Billy the Mountain, that for the most part has to be played a specific way. That's a compositional thing. And the drums are always he's going to play those parts. And that's, you know, I'm just glad he came back for this because there is a lot more. I mean, you know, obviously Big Swifty is an example of something that is open and where he could really just kick ass. But he does. Even the compositional stuff, like he's just on it all the time.
Yeah.
And who can you replace him with but Jim Gordon? So
definitely not the player that Ainsley is, but Jim had a great feel. So you go from this super open, slinky, virtuosic, is that a word? Virtuoso approach, you know, on the drums. To a guy who is a groove player with a pretty decent improvisational vocabulary under his belt. But thank God Jim Gordon could read music and to play those parts, because that was like so integral to be able to pull that shit off. In my opinion, Jim Gordon wasn't like the best drummer that Frank ever had. He did a good job doing what he had to do for that gig. But, I mean, he was no Ralph Humphrey, let's face it.
Well, yeah. It's true.
When Ralph came in, it was just like a complete change of the guard, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you really turned my head around in my attitude toward Ralph, because I had been not looking at Ralph correctly in terms of his ability to execute, particularly the written parts, so perfectly every time. Because, you know, you're talking about, okay, well, Ainsley, Jim Gordon, Ralph, and then Chester Thompson, right? So, and then on to Terry and all that stuff. And Ralph was always just, he was kind of there in the middle, you know? And then when I started to really go back and listen and realize like how perfect he was for that band with Jean-Luc Ponty, it was, you know, I mean, that I credit you with that, because you kind of, you turned my head around about that.
This is the this is the precursor to our drummers episode, Phil.
It is.
It is. It is.
We are going to do it one of these days.
There's so many intriguing things. You know, Jim Gordon, legend. But when we hear him on these recordings with Frank, you know, it's not the greatest live drum sound. So it's hard to, you know, you have to kind of take that into consideration, too. You know, what
it's
if
a
he was
strange drum sound?
It's a very strange. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to say, if you're a fan of cowbell, this box set is for you.
Yeah. Well, the horn players, believe it or not, were playing cowbells, you know, up against the horn players were like playing percussion sometimes. They'd be right up on the mic with that friggin' cowbell. But, you know, I think that drum sound had a lot to do with Barry Keane and the way that he was miking it, because Jim Gordon had single-headed tom-toms. Mm-hmm. And okay. I think he was taking the microphones and putting them all the way inside the drums, all the way up to the top of the batter head, right?
Wow.
So
the super close mic.
Yeah. So when you put the microphone on the top of the drum, that's the standard way to mic it. But when you put it inside the drum, and if you put it real close to the drum head, you're gonna get all that attack and not a lot of the air, right?
So, it sounds like he's hitting like a large flat plastic sheet.
I know.
That's it.
Yeah.
Perfect description.
That's what I think was going on there. I think
that's so interesting. Wow.
The miking technique was really enabling that real percussive ticky sound.
Yeah, you could really hear it on the bootleg audience recordings. Like it really comes through there. That it really sounds like he's hitting a large plastic sheet there. That's really good.
Well, I think that's the perfect way to segue into the Winterland show.
I think it is. That's kind of where I was going with that. Last show of the Petite, and you actually told us that it's Petite, not Petit, Wazoo band, which was, by the way, not ever actually called the Petite Wazoo by Frank. Right?
No, but he endorsed it when it was brought to him.
Do you know who coined it or how?
It had to have been somewhere in the fan base that was coined. And then it was brought to his attention. I'm almost going to say, because I tried to do this research years and years ago, and I thought, where did this name come from and when did Frank ever use it? And then I realized Frank never used it, but he endorsed it. And he endorsed it specifically, and I think it's the interview of the century with Den Sims. And I believe that was where.
We always go back to that interview.
It's such a great interview. Yeah. I mean, you know, it really is, even though it's a hard one to get through. But at least information-wise, we get a lot of information out of Frank. And that was really integral. Like, you know, when they said Petite Wazoo, or, you know, whenever Den mentions that, Frank just goes, yep. Like, he was like, yep, that's you know, that's it. That's what that band was. So even though it wasn't an official name by Frank, it was an endorsed name by Frank. So interesting.
It doesn't he refer to in that interview as sort of like souvenir recordings? Is all he had of that band.
Yeah, which is what he called the Boston show. The Boston, the two-track tape was like just like a memoir or whatever the fuck you want to call it. But I forget exactly how he worded it. But Yeah, you know, I don't know how Frank really felt about some of those four-track tapes in the vault, really. I just don't know if he ever really considered them super important. But in the long run, you know, in our generation, now that he's gone, it's like, yes, they're important. Yes, they're historical. Yes, they sound good. And yes, people want to hear them. And we know that there's a market for people that want to hear this stuff. And this is a prime example. It's like, I didn't need to put the Winterland show in the box, but I thought this would be something really nice.
I'm so glad you did.
Yeah. To bookend the whole experience. It's like, let's historically represent what was the very last thing in this little chapter, this window of time in the Zappa world that we're glorifying and celebrating for the 50th anniversary. It makes sense to include the last show. And I will say that the Winterland show isn't without its issues. I mean, it's historically really great. Sonically, it's got some things, but it's still really entertaining. And I think it works, and it fits well in the box.
Yeah, I love that America Drinks. That's just, you know, like, that's maybe now my favorite version of that song. Like, it's friggin' amazing. I'm sorry, Phil, I cut you off.
Oh, no, that's good. That's a great one. It makes me think it was kind of perverted Duke Ellington, America Drinks. That,
totally. Absolutely.
The tape sounds wonderful. That Winterland show it's super listenable, super enjoyable. Do you know why he goes, "Hello, Claremont," at the beginning of it?
Yeah, if you listen really closely, it's a private joke. One of the horn players says it to him off mic.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was listening really closely.
Yeah.
And then I get that bit of feedback and I have to turn it down again.
Yeah. No, you'll hear one of the horn players say, "Hello, Claremont," like that, and then Frank repeats it in the so it was something in between the band that was going on there. But you know what my favorite version of America Drinks is? The version on the 40th anniversary of Zappa in New York.
I was thinking that.
Terry,
yeah,
man.
That is gorgeous.
Terry, that's where you get to be like, yeah, there's such a difference in drummers, because Terry just kills it. He just sounds so good on that. And just it all just goes like this. It just comes together, you know, the way Terry plays it. So great.
You know, it's funny because when I was talking about Winterland being my new favorite version of that, it did occur to me, like, all right, what am I saying before I...
that's okay.
I think that what's really cool about the Winterland version is that it's like 2 years after the recording of the Jean-Luc Ponty Plays the Music of Frank Zappa record, right? King Kong. And that's the first time we get to hear that arrangement of America Drinks that way. So you get to hear it, you know, under Frank's baton with Jim Gordon being, you know, super loose and... So it is a good version, and I just wish that damn modulation effect wasn't in there. There was not much that we could do about that modulation effect. So Barry Keane was implementing this modulation effect on Frank's voice. It's like this real stuttery kind of an effect that Frank liked sometimes. You can hear it on Cosmic Debris. And then sometimes Barry would put it on an instrument. And for America Drinks, you can hear it on, I think it's Earl Dumler's oboe, I think, or something like that, or whatever it is. And it's just like, it's so irritating to hear. It's just like, so we tried to smooth it out with the audio restoration tools that we have with John Polito. We tried to smooth it out a little bit. And he did make it listenable where it's like, okay, yeah, it's there, but it's not like... you know?
God,
unbelievable.
So are those tapes, the Winterland tapes, those are not simply board tapes, right? That is a four-track recording.
It's a four-track recording, and it's pretty ambient. It's all submixed, so you don't really have many choices of what you can adjust. So you kind of have to put all four of them up, and then you can dial down the amount of ambience. Now, that's the one thing about those shows on those tapes, that four-track tape, is that Winterland Ballroom, boy, that place was big. And depending on where you place the mics, it's just like sound is traveling all over. It sounds like they're playing in a huge hall. And so that's all over those tapes. So John Polito, who mixed the Winterland show from the tapes, he brought down the audience mics a bit, because otherwise it's just swimming, you know, in the hall.
Sure.
And another thing that I will tell you, which you might find interesting, is that when we put together Imaginary Diseases, that record was put together from all stereo mixes from Frank. Yep. But in most instances, we didn't have any idea where some of that stuff came from. Like, we didn't know what shows some of that stuff came from. Some I did a lot of research and was able to get almost all of them. But the one that I didn't know was Farther Oblivion. Yeah. So when you listen to Imaginary Diseases, you can see we don't know where the source is. Well, in doing the forensic work to get all of the bits and pieces of the Winterland show from all these different reels that Frank cut them all up, to get them all back in sequence, I realized, oh my gosh, these portions of Farther Oblivion was released on Imaginary Diseases. So he used two sections of the Winterland show for that master version of Farther Oblivion. We would have never known that unless I did the work to try to put these fortune. Because Frank, I'm telling you, like, Montana was on a different reel and it was unmarked. And, you know, sections of Farther Oblivion were God knows where. And it takes such forensic work to try to get these things back in sequence. It's Frank left everything in such a disarray.
How do you know where to? I mean, I know you've obviously been doing this for almost 30 years now, but how do you know where to look? Because to me, every time you're missing something in the multi, you're talking about a needle in a haystack at best.
Yep.
And it literally could be anywhere, right?
You have to have everything transferred, and then you have to start going through all the transfers and literally by ear try and track it down. And then also look at the workflow, like what else is on the reel, and, you know, does it help in the data process of trying to get it all together? But, and then it's also trial and error. Like, you could actually take the missing parts of Farther, put them in a Pro Tools session along with a master tape that has the missing ones, yeah, and then see if they match sonically. Mm-hmm. And immediately you'll know, like, oh yeah, that audience doesn't sound like this. The audience tracks don't sound the same or whatever. Or that trumpet is in the left channel. That's not the way that it is on Winterland. So that won't work. But like the moment that you find it, you're like, ah, there it is. I can't believe it. I found it. You know?
Have you ever been working on a project? I think I know the answer to this question, but have you ever been working on a project that you really wanted to finish and you just could not find that missing piece?
Yes, I do believe that there are some instances. I was really bummed out that I didn't find the very end of the Orchestral Favorites concert when Beefheart comes out. Beefheart comes out and plays, and that was not recorded. I don't understand why they didn't record that, or if it was recorded, it was removed and I just haven't found it. So
craziness.
And also there is some things with the Record Plant 1970 project that I still haven't found yet that I'm trying to find, like trying to find mixes. Okay. So for instance, do you know in Shake Your Booty in the links between the songs where like Terry Bozzio and Patrick O'Hearn are talking?
Yeah.
And in the background you can hear music. Okay. Mm-hmm. In the background you can hear music. Well, the music that's in the background is from the 1970 Basement Jam with Ainsley, Max Bennett, and Ian and Frank. And it's being run through a Leslie cabinet. See, these are really super, super nerdy things that nobody would know. So, but it's like I'm trying to find those mixes. I'm trying to find those exact mixes. I found the 4-track tape. Wow. That it was recorded on, but I haven't found the mixes in complete form yet. So it's just like, God, where are you? Because everything is unmarked. And it's just like walls and walls of tape. I'm like,
you've been working on this 30-year-old crossword puzzle, Joe.
Yeah, I know.
That's a good way of putting it.
So true.
You'll have to demix from the Shake Your Booty interstitials. Pull it out of there.
George Martin.
This triggers a question from one of our listeners who it goes like this. Scott just had a thought. Scott, comma, just had a thought. The new tech used to separate instruments on a tape with, say, only 3 tracks used famously on Let It Be and Revolver to separate those tracks out, I guess. My mind turned to Frank, and if there are early tapes currently unusable that could be rescued using this technology?
Well, I'm sure it could. One of the things that I think about right off the top of my head when we talk about that is the fact that on the absolutely free 4-track tapes, the master tapes, on the song American Drinks and Goes Home, all of the cash register and the people that you hear in the mix, it's not on the four track.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that means they flew it in when they mixed it back in 1966. So where did they get that from? I have not found the source tape of those, the cash registers and the people screaming and carrying on. So it would be nice to get that isolated so that if we were to ever do a remix someday, that we would have control over that. But right now, we don't have it at all. We don't have the source at all. So that would be kind of cool to see if we could extract that, right?
Yeah.
See if it, good experiment.
That's funny. You went to Absolutely Free, and I thought, why don't you do me right? Is mono, that would be...
Oh, we talked about this, yeah.
Does the stereo mix of that exist or no?
Good question. Well, the four-track does, so we could remix it in stereo.
Hmm.
But, gosh, I don't know if there is a vintage stereo mix of that song at all. I'll have to check and see.
So, yeah, there was another guy who had sent me a message saying, you know, maybe Joe could take the tapes to Abbey Road, where Peter Jackson, you know, used that technology that they have at Abbey Road to... separate out these tracks, which is, you know, I guess must be the best in the world, I suppose, of version of that technology. But I said, yeah, Joe's gonna fly from Los Angeles to London.
No thanks. I mean, I would do that, of course, if I got requested to
flying.
Do it. Yeah, I love it so much. especially going to Europe and back. That's really fun.
Yeah.
I would do it. I mean, I've heard about so many different types of technologies and companies that offer the same results. And there are people in Los Angeles that do it. I know Amit knows some people that have come to us and, you know, purported to be the best. So, I mean, it is what it is. I haven't really run into a situation where I feel that it's necessary to have to do it.
Yeah.
But when you talk about surround mixing and Dolby Atmos and immersive audio specifically now, which is being pushed by the industry unbeknownst to the world at large, who probably could care less about surround music. It's been proven time and again, ladies and gentlemen, that SACD and DVD audio and quadraphonic, it all failed.
Yeah,
nobody cares. No, that's not true. People do care, but the people that do care are willing to press the right buttons to make it happen. And that's the good thing about Dolby Atmos, is that that's the thing about Dolby Atmos that's going to win, is that in the past, in order to benefit from listening to the surround sound mix of Kind of Blue on SACD or, you know, whatever the hell it was, the, you know, Quadiophiliac, for instance, or Zappa Halloween, you had to make sure that, like, you turn your TV on, you turn your Blu-ray player, or I mean your DVD audio player on. You have to press the button for the right audio track. And then you have to make sure that your receiver is pressed so that it's receiving that audio track. And like all those buttons, people are just like, screw this.
Right, right.
Like this is stupid. I don't want to do this. I just want to press play and go. Well, that's what happens with Dolby Atmos, is that you press play and you go. Because when it comes in, it automatically knows what kind of system that you have, whether it's 5-1, 7-1, 12 speakers in a studio, no matter what. It will know. If you're listening to it on headphones, it'll know. And it will go directly to the stream that complements what your system is, if it's a headphones or whatever. So that's like, it's made it that easy for the consumer. Guess what? You don't have to press a single button, people.
Just play.
All you have
just
to do
play.
Is press
just
play.
Play it.
Yeah. So the chances of Dolby Atmos and immersive audio being successful in today's world, especially to the point where all these record companies are pushing it now, it's got better chances than ever, okay?
Yeah.
So my point is now, after all that rant, is that if surround sound music becomes important, then I think that this technology that you guys are talking about, okay, it becomes more important. Because now you're like, okay, if you only have a four-track master to mix from, how do you get some isolation and some control over some of these instruments that are buried in these tracks?
Yeah.
So that makes sense. That makes sense.
It does. I mean, you know, but the odds, you know, going back to what you were saying about the industry pushing stuff, the odds that anybody will want to spend a lot of money on new equipment just to listen to something immersive in the way that it was intended to be, a very relatively few people will do that. I've done it. you know, I'm quite sure you've done it. Phil, you've probably done it too.
I did it back in 2004.
Yeah.
But now I don't think I'm going to do it. I mean, you know, in order for me to do the immersive audio in my apartment, I have to buy like a whole new receiver.
Yep.
I have to buy those two speakers that sit on top of your main speakers that shoot up.
Yep.
And then it's like this fake, because I don't want to do that. How am I going to wire up 12 speakers in my apartment? No way.
Yeah.
No way. So there's like all these different ways that you can get around it and buy it. And I don't care.
It's a lot. It's a lot. But I hear what you're saying. They're trying to make this as user-friendly as possible in terms of people with existing things. A lot of people who already have home theater, they should hear it decoded on their 5.1 or 7.1, whatever they
have. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, at the very minimum, it's fun to hear on headphones off of like a streaming service, you know?
Yeah. And that's another thing too, is like Dolby Atmos is happening at a time when streaming is really popular, right? Mm-hmm. DVD audio and SACD didn't have that going for it. It was all physical media only.
Yeah.
So you're not just limited to physical media this time. But if you get the Waka Wazoo box set, you get a Blu-ray that has all the immersive, you get the immersive mixes.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. And you get the high res, you know, 96K high res mastered versions of the two original albums, which is really good.
Okay. Rapid fire question. If you could pick a Frank album to have in Dolby Atmos, that's not yet in Dolby Atmos, what would it be?
Go, Scott.
Oh my God.
I already know the answer to mine.
All right. I already know the answer to mine.
All right. Let me think, because I don't want to be obvious.
No, don't think. Just
okay,
say
well
it.
Then.
Rapid fire. Okay. Roxy and Elsewhere.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep.
Hot Rats for me.
I was going to say Hot Rats, but, you know, it's a movie for your ears, baby.
That's right.
I was going to say You Are What You Is.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's a good one.
That
just
would be good.
It's such a dense, wonderful studio production.
Extremely dense.
One thing I wanted to say, speaking of attention to detail in packaging, is the colored vinyl reissues of...
Oh, my gosh. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yes. Of Grand Wazoo, Waka Chewaka. They're coming, folks.
Yes. So both records are being reissued. And I was under the impression that these reissues were going to be tip-on jackets for the entire consumer release. Mm-hmm. But instead, what they did was they made the black vinyl and standard jackets available to the consumer, and they made the colored vinyl and the tip-on jackets available for the e-com versions, which are the special pre-order versions that you can only get through the Zappa store and you Discover, I believe.
Yep.
And if you don't hop on the train and get those right away, they're going to sell out really quick.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, what? I thought we were going to do tip-ons for everything, you know, what the hell?
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, ugh. So I even did that. Like I even pre-ordered the tip-ons with the colored vinyl. So I just bought them because I'm not going to wait for them to send them to me. I just wanted I just had to have it. I'm really excited about it. And I want everybody to know that we used the exact same analog tapes that was used to make the original 1972 issues, the Bizarre Label issues.
Wow.
Bernie Grundman mastered them directly from the original tapes that made those tapes. I'm going to get technical for just a second. Maybe, Phil, you might dig this. But check this out. So sometimes people say, well, you have to cut from the original master tape or else it ain't worth a shit, right? Well, sometimes cutting from the original, like the very, very, very first one, sometimes that's not beneficial or representative of what people know their records to be. Hmm. And this is an exact example. I'm gonna spell this out for you. So the original tape, there was some level issues between tracks. Okay. So you can see right on there that Kerry McNabb writes, when Blessed Release starts, you know, go minus 2 dB.
Mm-hmm.
And when Cletus Auritus Auritus plus 1, like you can see the mastering engineer notes, right?
Yeah.
So when the mastering engineer is doing these EQ changes and these level changes in real time, as the lathe is cutting, what they're doing is they're actually creating a new master on a tape. Uh-huh. And that's called the EQ duplication master, mm-hmm. right? So basically is what they've done is all those moves and all those changes from the original tape has now been documented on another tape. And that is what people should be cutting from because that's where all the work was done.
Yeah.
If you use the original master, you have to redo all of those moves, right? And it's just a pain in the ass sometimes. I mean, it's expensive because mm-hmm. it's going to be more studio time. And believe me when I tell you, I transferred the original and I transferred the EQ mm-hmm. DC copy, and they both sound beautiful. Wow. Beautiful. So we just, you know, and it's Dolby encoded as well. So we just took the EQ DCs so that Bernie could just, you know, cut from the work that was already done. And that is an original master tape, in my opinion, even though it wasn't the first generation one. It reflects exactly what you bought in 1972, you see. So sometimes that's the chain of events.
I wanted to bring up a couple more things about the set. One is George Duke as most valuable player. Or, you know,
I was going to say that too.
Well, we have to talk about the demos.
Those demos are
sick.
They're sick. Yeah,
they really are.
It's rare when you hear Frank just like collaborating with someone and like that. And it just makes you think of like the deep respect they had for each other. And they're amazing demos. I really
felt like it was a no-brainer to include them because it was the same studio, the same engineer, the same band.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And in the same time period. So, and you've got Frank playing on everything and producing it. So to me, it's like the lost Frank Zappa tapes, you know.
Mm-hmm. They're crazy. Amazing. I'm so glad you included them. I've had that George Duke album feel and a bunch of his albums for like since the mid 80s and know these tracks. And then to hear him with more Frank on them, to hear him with Ainsley's drumming on them.
Exactly.
Oh my God. It's mind blowing.
And Erroneous too. It's crazy.
And Erroneous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great. It's really great to hear more material from this band that only lasted in the studio.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was really excited to include them. I remember when I was telling Amit about putting this Waka Wazoo thing together, I said, we have to include these. Please don't tell me that we can't because they're just ideal. You know, I'm really happy that there was no issue with including the Duke stuff because it was so perfect for the box set. It just really was. And I love those tracks anyway. I just love George's music. I love those records, all those records that he did on MPS. I collected them all. I have them all on vinyl. I went crazy trying to get those on eBay and stuff like that because those are really great records. All those records are great.
They're fantastic.
But here we hear these like premature versions, you know, with Frank all over it. It's just
instrumental Uncle Remus. With the melody being played by a low octave on the Rhodes or something. I don't know what's making that melody, but it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because the words hadn't been written yet.
Now, here's something I wanted to say, and I don't think I've ever brought this up, but do we know who wrote the melody for Uncle Remus? Was that George or Frank?
My guess is probably George.
Yeah? Yeah. It's interesting because if you go back to Run Home Slow, the music that Frank did, if anybody has ever seen this movie, which is a really tough movie to get through, folks, let's be objective about this. Notwithstanding the fact that the only available copies are really terrible and dark and all that stuff. But there's a theme that the nymphomaniac cowgirl, that as Frank put it, is singing, which it's star in the morning. Da, na, 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 na. And it's orchestrated later. So theoretically, that's a melody maybe, who knows, that Frank came up with. But have you seen us, Uncle Remus? I always thought there was a similarity between the two.
Well, that's interesting.
It's pretty close if you listen to it.
It's a deep dive.
That's a very deep dive. Yeah. That's a deep dive way off into the... That's a deep dive... into a pool that has no water in it.
That's like those interstitials on Chic or Booty, you know.
Yeah,
it's a deep
so
cut.
Random. It's such just such a random thing.
Another thing we have to touch upon before this podcast ends is the fact that two experts wrote the liner notes for this box set.
Oh, man, I was so happy that the team were into having Scott write for this because I knew that Scott had already done a lot of work about this period with the books that he writes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it was, it only made sense to incorporate his work in this. And yeah, it was really well done. And congratulations, Scott Parker.
I keep thinking, you know, because I was looking at the book again today that comes with the box. Mm-hmm. 'Cause folks, we get these things before you, I hate to tell you. And and I'm looking, and it's so fucking surreal. I mean, you know, like when you first saw your name on a Frank Zappa album, Joe, how surreal was it to see? And I've been thanked.
Crazy.
I mean, thank you, because I had been thanked on other albums. But it's so surreal that, you know, I want to go back to that 16-year-old geeky kid's totally obsessed with Frank and go, listen, just stay the course, kid. It's going to be good. thank you a million times over. 'Cause you know, that's a dream come true. You know, if that's all I ever am remembered for in life, I'm fine with that. So,
well, you did a great job.
They're great liners. Both Joe, as usual, great liners. Scott, after reading your liners, it really puts what an incredibly prolific year that was, more than you even thought. You bring up all these things, the George Duke demos, the Rubin and the Jets.
That's another thing, yeah.
It's just like so much in this time Hunch that you don't toot. Really think of like that. But boy, for a guy who was in a wheelchair for many months, damn, he made a lot of art.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to a lot of this box set, I kept thinking about like, this is music for Frank to heal by, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
Some of it is just so incredibly beautiful. I mean, it's all beautiful, but some of it's like, this is so unlike anything he's done before.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, Blessed Relief is one of my favorite songs that he's ever done, and talk about beautiful. And the fact that we get a chance to hear another completely different take, you know, how did we ever think that we would ever hear, you know, the lyrics to Think It Over sung or any of the stuff that's on here? It's just like, you know, if you really love these two records, this box set is going to be a really special listen for you because it's so revealing. It gives you more of what you loved in the beginning. It gives you more of it. You know, it's just like, wow.
I mean, you know, it's funny because there's another album that you could have included in the set, but you didn't have to because you released it already in 2004. And that could have been disc one of a 5-disc version of this, but you didn't have to. And that, of course, is Joe's Dommage.
Yeah, it's the perfect companion, and so is the Wazoo release. In fact, thankfully, the Waka Wazoo box set was an outlet for us to be able to release that FZ-treated version of Approximate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've already released it live, untreated, you know, just from the master tape on that concert. So, yes, Joe's Dommage and Wazoo are the perfect companions for this box set. And it all should be bundled together. It all should be in a playlist on your Spotify.
And this podcast.
And this podcast.
And this podcast, yeah, exactly.
The audio documentary, ladies and gentlemen. So,
yes. Well, all in all, this is a very exciting box, and I'm really proud of it. And I'm really happy that we got together to talk about it because this is one of those ones that we're like, you know, it's one of those real special ones, you know.
It's another beautiful 50th anniversary release, and just keep them coming, Joe. Just keep them coming.
I will.
ZappaCast, the official Frank Zappa podcast, is created by and is hosted by Scott Parker. Our producer is Phil Circus. For the latest Zappa news and more, visit Zappa.com. We're also on Instagram and Twitter at Zappa. Until next time, good night, boys and girls.